Hi, everybody. My name's Debbie. I'm alcoholic. Hi. It's good to be here. And thanks for inviting us. It's been a beautiful couple days for us so far. It's been a long time since I've been through these mountains. When I was a kid, my dad was born and raised in Tennessee, in northeastern Tennessee, a town of Elizabethton. And we'd make this trip about every year. Now, my dad, I believe, is an alcoholic. He doesn't drink anymore because he's in a nursing home and he's been there for a long time. But I believe he drank like an alcoholic when he could. And he was also raised by an alcoholic mother who died of alcoholism. Her liver and kidneys failed and was ugly. And I believe he was affected by alcoholism. I don't think you even have to drink to be affected by alcoholism, for sure. Anyway, when we would take our family vacations through these mountains, my dad was road rage before it was fashionable. You know, he was slamming the steering wheel and cussing because we always got behind a truck, a big truck, going through the Cumberland Gap. That's one of the most powerful memories that I have every time of Tennessee. And it wasn't just we were behind a truck. It was, you know, it was all about him. It was because he was going through the mountains that that truck was put in front of him. And if it rained on the trip, if we had plans outside, it was because he had plans that it rained. And I believe, you know, I relate to that. I recognize that in my own life, and that being affected by alcoholism can make me take everything that life dishes out real personal. And that's how I grew up. I mean, alcoholism was all through my family. Like I said, my mother's father died of it. My father's mother died of it. And my sister drinks a lot, but she doesn't drink like me, so she's okay. You know, she's comparing her drinking to mine, and that's unfortunate. But I mean, it was all around me. People were affected. People behaved a certain way because of how they were treated by their teachers and their parents and the people that were influential in their lives. And growing up, I took everything real personal. Somebody just told my sister the other day at work, she said, they told me I just take everything so personal, I couldn't believe it. She said, if you knew my dad, you would too. And I thought, you know, that was like 40 years ago. I'm so grateful that this program of Alcoholics Anonymous puts the responsibility for my reaction to life on my shoulders. It's nobody's fault anymore. I'm not a victim. I heard when I came to AA, there are no sober victims. I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't know anything. I knew that I was real self-conscious, which is a short definition of my problem, if there can, you know, distill it down to that. I was real self-conscious. I was conscious only of me. It's like I had a mirror taped to the end of my forehead, right at the end of my nose. My whole life, growing up, everything was about me. I was self-centered. I took everything personal. I was certain everybody was looking at me, talking about me. And I was singled out some growing up as a kid. I thought I was a weird kid. I was a weird kid. You know, I was singled out some. I was given special tests. I was put in special classes. I had a speech impediment. I mean, I was laughed at, and I was lower blue-collar class. Lower to middle class. I mean, my dad was a bartender, and, you know, it seemed like everybody else's kids had daddies that were doctors or salesmen or something. You know, my daddy was a bartender. I grew up in a bowling alley, and used to think I was a victim of that, and, you know, that was fun, actually. That was kind of fun. And all the characters that would be around, I remember the old men that drank in the morning, that sat on the bar stools, that just loved my dad because he made him their first drink. You know, the Bloody Marys, oh, Johnny, you saved my life. And I heard that. And when I started drinking, I did not ever wait until 5 o'clock, ever, maybe 5 a.m. But it just seemed a normal way to deal with life. Everybody I knew did that. And I had a lot of secrets. I was embarrassed a lot as a kid. I had a lot of shame involving what you thought of me because of outside things, where I lived and who my family was and what we drove and the clothes I wear and all that external stuff. And I just had a difficult time dealing with life from the beginning. I mean, this is way before I took a drink. I was a mess before I ever took a drink. Drinking was hallelujah, there is something to make this better, is what I thought. It was an absolute miracle for me to finally drink enough. And when I was 14 when I did that, just getting started in high school. And I'd never been raised in any kind of spiritual environment. My dad has said, my dad was in World War II, and his dad died when he was young, and different things he said made him not believe in God anymore. And I don't know what my mother was. We never went to church. I had one brief experience at Sunday school or vacation, something or another, and this little kid in the neighborhood asked me if I wanted to go, and they had cookies, and I said, well, sure. And I went, and I know they were trying to be nice. The lady said, well, Debbie's our visitor. We'll have her say the blessing. And I just froze. I didn't know what that was. I had never heard a blessing said in my life. And I remember thinking, if I make it through this, I'm never coming back. And I didn't. So I had no spiritual upbringing at all, nothing to rely on. I remember thinking, self-will, what else is there when I got sober? It's like, God's will, Debbie. Oh. The most important thing in my life up till like some 22 years later was a spiritual experience for me. Drinking enough alcohol was absolutely a spiritual experience for me. It changed the world, it changed me, and it changed you, and I became okay. And I said, I'm gonna drink this stuff for the rest of my life. And I almost did. I came real close to doing that. I drank for about 22 years. And I drank alcoholically from the beginning. I mean, I didn't cross a line ever gradually. And that's really actually been a great gift for me. When I finally looked at my life, there was no getting around it. You know, there was no, well, I really didn't drink that long or that much or that way. I mean, I drank just as much as I could, as often as I could from the very beginning. I had a lot of trouble. I mean, it didn't gradually work into that either. I got expelled from high school. I was talking to some new friends at dinner tonight about I was invited to my high school reunion when I was 2 years sober, and I was stunned. I'd been expelled. Why would they invite me? And I really didn't want to go. And it was a huge gift that I did. It changed my life. And you all shared your experience with me about that, which allowed me to go. Nobody said, you have to go, Debbie. But I mean, I was kicked out of high school. I was a cheerleader. I'd become a cheerleader in junior high. Now, I thought being very external oriented, you know, outside stuff, who your family, what your last name was, what your job was, kind of deal, the car, that if I would get something like prestige-wise, that I'd be okay. And, you know, 14 years old, I'm jumping around with pom-poms going rah-rah, and it didn't change anything. Didn't change anything inside of me, and it didn't help externally either. People still didn't like me. A lot more people didn't like me because they thought they should have been cheerleader. And what's that loser doing up there jumping up and down? So I learned early, it was real confusing to me. If you succeed, people don't like you. If you do poorly, because I did poorly in school. I mean, I never had the knack. I learning disorders and all, but they didn't know that then. They just repeat it to me louder, the same thing, and I get it. And it just made me hate myself. But if I did badly, I got in trouble, and so the idea was to do well. So I did well, I thought, in something, and it didn't work either. So if you can't win and you can't lose, it's like, what's left? I couldn't play. I couldn't participate. And that's a real, real sad and lonely place, and that's where I was for over 20 years. And I just created a lot of wreckage. I made a lot of decisions. I read this the other day, and then those decisions made me. The book says I made decisions based on self. And I made decisions based on fear and getting approval and simple just selfishness, self-seeking, what's in it for me. That was always what motivated me. And I remember being so shocked after I got kicked out of high school. I didn't know what to do. All my drinking and drugging buddies, you know, were still going to school. I'd hitchhike to school and then just kind of sit out in the parking lot and wonder what the heck had happened. This was supposed to be a party. This was good. These were all my buddies, and they were coming to my house. You know, I was that lower companion back then. You know, it's not, nobody was quite as bad as me. They really didn't want to be seen with me. I guess I made a series of decisions. My mom and I moved to another state. We moved to Pennsylvania after I'd gotten kicked out of high school. I was having a really hard time dealing with my dad. My dad, as I said, was, I believe, an alcoholic, and he had a lot of pride. And my mother divorced my dad in 1963 and took my sister and I, and he never got over that. And as the way he dealt with that was to badmouth my mother every time him and I were together, to call her horrible names and say terrible things about her. And even if they were true, I guarantee that no kid wants to hear that about their parent. And the effect he wanted was that it would bring us kids closer to him, and what it did was drive us away. And in order, I really think, to get me away from him, because we would have knocked down, screaming, throwing, breaking stuff fights. And we moved up to Pennsylvania, and it was a very interesting, it was a big change from central Missouri. They went a lot faster, and I could drink. I mean, anywhere I got jobs where I could drink. I always had jobs either in restaurants, bars, or motels. And I really liked the motels because I had like a little bar on wheels. It had towels and soap and stuff on it, but it always had bottles. It would just kind of go clinking down the hallway as my little bar cart. And nobody was watching over me when I worked, so I could drink, and I'd suck down vodka and chew peppermints, and I didn't think anybody, you know, when I smelled like vodka and peppermint. You know, it's no big secret. So, I mean, this is what I'm doing up in Pennsylvania. My drinking kind of shifted gears. I was hanging out with old men who drank in the morning. I was comfortable. You know, just because it's not healthy doesn't mean it's not comfortable. I fit right into that. And again, a lot of bad decisions. I hurt a lot of people. I hurt myself. I was hanging out with, there was this little nightclubby kind of horrible little dive. They had little go-go dancers and female impersonators. And I mean, I was hanging out doing drugs, amyl nitrates with, you know, female impersonators. I was 16 years old, and it just seemed normal to me. And we moved back before it got really crazy up there in 1976. And the bicentennial, they were really getting weird up there. And well, I sure was. And I came back, and I got a job at a bar my sister worked at. And this guy comes in one night. I was 21 years old. This guy walks in, he's got real long hair and tattoos and a beard, and he's got all these little toadies around him, you know, yes men, and they're all getting him drinks, and they're snorting coke on the bar. And I mean, my little heart just went pitter-pat. This was the man for me. He was a drug dealer just out of prison, out of El Reno, Oklahoma, and I just thought, you know, perfect. And we ended up getting married, and the thing about that was, this man is an alcoholic, and I can say that about him, and a drug addict, and he's a very sick man, and he did not treat me very well, and was abusive. He slapped me around, he cheated on me, treated me badly, and I was right there in his face, I guarantee, every time. I mean, I wielded iron skillets and telephones. Anybody else break a lot of telephones? Oh, my God. How many of those things can you break? And I mean, up against his head, he'd go down, but he wouldn't go out. He was like 6'3" and weighed about 250, and he never went all the way out. And he'd come up swinging. But these things that happened before I married him. And that's an important part of my story, because a sane person probably wouldn't have married someone that treated him that way. And I did. I think looking back through inventories and talking with other women, that's probably what I thought I deserved. That's probably about what I thought I could get. And it's interesting, he kind of resurfaced in my life here in the last few months. He'd been in prison again for 7 years, and I know his cousin roasted a pig at our wedding. I mean, I caught on fire at my own wedding reception, okay? Every picture that we have has got triple beam scales in the background, and I mean, I'd sweep the floor afterwards for months, and a drug dealer that was there was a bunch of Harley riders came down, robbed a pharmacy, and that was our wedding gift. This box of, you know, red, blue, pink, I don't know what they were. There was a case of whiskey and three kegs and a lot of guns, and they were firing them at the outhouse, and I'm thinking, God, I hope nobody's in there. And people come the next morning, they come walking out of the woods and out of the barn. I'm like, who are these people? And just sweep the floor and take some different colored pills and it'll be okay. And so anyway, many years later, he's gotten out of prison again, and I know his cousin. He had the pig roast, the bonfire that I was standing a little too close to. Somebody hollered across at me. He's like, hey, Debbie, you're on fire. They just all threw beer on me and went on. I mean, it was just normal. I saved those jeans for a long time. They had this big burnt place in them. So anyway, I need to talk to this man. I need to tell this man that there's no bad feelings for me about all that whole deal. And I figured he's out of prison. I'm ready. And his cousin says to me, well, you better hurry up. The last time I saw him, he had a bag of dope hanging out of his pants pocket, had a six-pack of beer, and like an Uzi when he came to get open the door. So you might hurry if you want to talk to him. And I did. I wasn't able to get a hold of him before I came down here. I wanted to, but when it didn't happen. But there isn't bad feeling anymore about that. There was for a long time. It was a decision I made. People tried to talk to me about that. You know, do you really think this is a good decision? Didn't care. It was party life. I wanted, the party was going. I wanted it. The party was at my house every day, though. That got really old. So anyway, I mean, I'm 25 years old. I divorced this man. He finally cracked my ribs, and that was enough for me. And I'm grateful I was able to get out. My husband's a retired policeman, and he has a file on women that were not lucky as I was, that did not get out in time. And it's alcoholism. I mean, God almighty, it's hideous. So I'm 25 years old, and I'm divorced from this man, and one of our best friends had moved up to Oregon and had shot himself in the heart. And I remember getting that news, and I was so sad, because this little guy and I drank alike. Not even with that bunch of bikers and pharmacy robbers and crazy, crazy drinking, they would point their finger at me and say, that girl's got a problem. I mean, they'd be sticking needles in their arms with buck knives full of white powder and slugging on Ezra Brooks whiskey at 8 o'clock in the morning and saying, that girl has a problem. I mean, here I am. Here I am. That's my life. You know, I'm divorced. This little buddy that I sat and drank NyQuil Sunday mornings because you couldn't get any booze till like 11 o'clock, and that was way too late. We'd sit at the kitchen table and drink NyQuil and say, wow, it feels like my hair's growing. Like, yeah. I mean, that was my morning. That was breakfast. And here he shot himself in the heart. And my ex-husband's calling me from Texas, where they're kicking him out of the state of Texas. Can they do that? I guess they can. That's what he said they were doing. Yeah? Okay. A fellow kick out. And about this time, my dad, who's a gambler, that's another one of his deals. He's a bookie. I mean, he never wanted to work at regular. The bowling alley that he had burned mysteriously when my mom divorced him. I always thought that was really kind of coincidental. But he became a small-time bookie in Columbia, Missouri, betting football, and he got a little cocky about it, and the IRS found him, and they don't like it. He made a lot of money, and they don't like it when you make a lot of money and don't pay taxes on it. So he was going to prison. They busted him. I mean, they busted through the door, sledgehammer. I mean, the whole bit. The phones were tapped, and well, this is just life. Oh, well, it's just kind of normal life at the Folsom residence. And so this is going down. Bobby shot himself. I'm getting divorced, and my husband's calling me up from Texas saying, marry me again, baby. And I mean, I'm just crazy. And dad's going to prison. And he says, Debbie, if you want to go see a psychiatrist, I'll pay for it. I said, okay. And I went and saw a psychiatrist. I think I was kind of depressed. There was a lot of crap going on. So I went and saw this psychiatrist. I was about 25 years old. Yeah, about 25 years old. And I take this MMPI test. Has anybody ever taken one of those tests? A lot of questions, man. A lot of really weird questions. And then they get the results back, and I came back in after he'd gotten the results back, and I sat down, and he said, Debbie, we'd like you to go home and ask your mother if they used forceps on you when you were born because we think you have brain damage. And I'm thinking, God, if I was depressed before I went in there, I'm really depressed now. I'm like, oh, they squeezed me too hard with the salad tongs is what he said. And my mom doesn't even remember. She didn't remember if that happened or not. And I asked her, and what was wrong with me was alcoholism. This guy told me how to cure my hangovers. Anybody want to know? I thought it was real interesting how you cure a hangover. He says, drink a lot of Gatorade and take 2 aspirin before you go to bed. And I thought, well, vodka goes with Gatorade, but I never know when I'm going to bed. I could never tell when I was going down. And when I went down, I never stayed down. I'd always get up and stay down, Debbie, stay down. So what kind of help was that? I left there just a horrible mess. So what did I do? I drank. I have an answer, and it's alcohol. People told me for a long time, Debbie, if you just stop drinking, you'll be all right, and I wasn't. I mean, a couple days, things got real creepy. I knew what would fix that, and it was another drink. And I'm drinking around the clock. Like I said, I'm drinking, and these bikers were looking at me like there was something wrong with me. So here I am, and I go through this series of bad relationships. My 4-step, they were listed as the young boys. I don't know their names. I don't care. I don't want to know. And I said, after it was over, I was back living with my mother. God bless her. She kept letting me move back in. And I finally had it. I said, you know, I'm not ever having, I don't want to ever see another man again as long as I live. I don't want anything to do with them ever, ever. And about this time, the man I'm married to now knocked on my door. Now, I believe he came to me. I didn't pick him. And that's why we're still together. I believe that. That was a surrender to me. I did not surrender anything to God. It was God who in my life. I mean, I didn't know, I didn't really think there wasn't a God, but I really figured it didn't have much to do with me if there was one. Figured you have to have a lot of education and be taught a lot of prayers and different things like that to have God want something to do with you, and I didn't know any of that. And certainly my behavior didn't warrant any kind of grace. And it really helped me when I got sober. I looked up the word grace, and it's unmerited. I don't have to do anything to deserve it. So anyway, this man shows up at my door. It was the night after a tequila binge for me. The guns had come out from somewhere in the tequila, and it was next door. I crawled home. I remember that was pretty normal. I could crawl home through the yard, passed out. I must have thrown up because it was on my robe, he says. I answered the door in this nasty, funky, you know, tequila afterglow. And I guess about 6 months later, we moved in together. That's his story. But I fell in love with this man. This unexpected, he's a retired policeman. Now, I go from, you know, parolee from federal penitentiary, drug dealer, to ex-policeman. So, it's going well. He drinks a little bit with me. We drink together. I always drink more than he does. He doesn't finish his drinks all the time. I remember being disturbed by that, but oh well, as long as it was around, I didn't think much about it. And he would say things once in a while, like, you okay? You're looking kind of bad. And oh, something I guess I kind of forgot was my first treatment center. Jesus, I've been in the hospital so many times, I forgot the first one. The first one was during that 25, when I was 25 years old or so, and they showed me films, and doctor came in and talked to us about liver damage and different things like that. And I remember thinking, that'll never happen to me. You know, that'll never happen to me. I'm fine. I was in my 20s. I was healthy. Well, it started happening to me. And I started changing. And I started looking bad. I mean, I didn't look great to begin with, but I started looking sick. My face got real swollen, and my face, the color got like almost a deep purple, the color of your blouse. All these blood vessels broke in my nose and my cheeks here. My hair started falling out. My nose started bleeding pretty regular. My gums were bleeding. I was throwing up a lot, and my liver started sticking out. My stomach, it looked like I was about 6 to 8 months pregnant. My husband starts saying, are you okay? You need to go to the doctor. And I didn't want to go to the doctor. I felt like if I went to the doctor, they'd keep me. And I didn't want to do that. And what happened was one night we'd gone to bed, and I had to get up and throw up again about the 50,000th time. And I did that, and I could not make it back to the bedroom from the bathroom. I couldn't breathe. And I was rushed to the emergency room, and the doctors all gathered around and did all these tests, and one of them threw back the curtain and said, how long have you been a diabetic? And I'm like, who said I'm a diabetic? I had no idea. My blood sugar registered 999 on that little glucometer, and that's as high as it goes, and that's dead is what that is. And my family came. I had some bleeding, internal bleeding. My pancreas was shot. I had pancreatitis real bad. I was in a lot of pain. And they called my family and they said I was going to die. They told them Debbie's going to die tonight. And that's a horrible thing for a family to hear. It really is a horrible thing for a family to have to deal with that. And to the astonishment of the doctors, I didn't die. I was in the hospital for 2 weeks in intensive care with no insurance, and I paid that bill off in my third year of sobriety, one payment at a time. It was like $45,000 or something. I mean, I got on Medicaid. I mean, alcoholism is progressive. Well, so was my recovery. I started out on Medicaid, government help, not being able to work, and I am not there now, and it's because AA works. Anyway, I mean, the psychiatrist came in to talk to me in the hospital, and the GI guys that were just amazed. I remember this one doctor running this stethoscope over my stomach, so on. It's just amazing what happens to the liver when you stop injuring it. 2 weeks I hadn't had a drink, and I got better. And they said, now, Debbie, you know, you can never drink again, ever, when they released me from the hospital. And I remember my head going, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Whatever, you bet. Whatever you say. And my head was saying, these guys, stupid doctors, what do they know? You know what you're telling me? My thought was, you telling me the thing I need to live is going to kill me if I drink it. Now, that's a terrible place to be. And I got out of that hospital, and my husband was ecstatic because I wasn't going to drink anymore, right? And I made it 3 months like this. I knew about AA at treatment center when I was in, you know, in about 1980, I guess. I was exposed to AA and I hated it. Didn't need it. I could do this myself. Thank you very much. And anyway, I didn't go when I got out of the hospital. And I quit smoking, too, at that point for 3 months. And those people told me all I needed to do was not drink alcohol, lied to me, because it was worse. I was more frightened, more angry, rageful, just a raging alcoholic woman. I mean, every place I lived had holes in the wall and broken stuff everywhere. I just raged. And I was meaner than I'd ever been in my life those 3 months. And my husband won't argue with you. And I didn't go to AA. And I remember what happened. I was on a job with my husband. He worked. I just kind of wandered around. We're home maintenance is we go into other people's houses. And they trust us with their homes, keys. And I'd go straight to their liquor cabinets like a hunting dog. I could just sniff it out. And I'm wandering around looking at pulling their medicine cabinets open, looking in their drawers, and he's working in the back room. And I open this cabinet, and there's all these little airplane bottles of booze, all lined up in order, kind of. And I remember just going, vodka. And I twisted that cap, and it cracked, and I threw it down, and I remember thinking, I wonder if this is going to kill me. And it never stopped me from taking it. Didn't even hesitate. I wonder if this is going to kill me. Fear is going to keep me sober? Didn't keep me sober. And I was off and running again, and it wasn't over the next few couple of years. I was in and out of that hospital 8 times. There had been a suicide attempt when I was in my 20s. There were a couple treatment centers long term, a couple like 30 days, 90 days, a 3 day. One time I checked myself into the nut ward. I thought I was just so brave. And I didn't tell anybody where I was going. So dramatic. And my husband knew where I was before I got there. He called the cab company that I called. I mean, I drank again every time. What they told me when I was 25 years old in that hospital, in that treatment center, about liver disease and stuff like that happened. My esophagus ruptured. It's called esophageal varices, and it did that 3 times. Every time I was rushed to the hospital and told again my family that I was going to die, and they're just astonished. They just could not believe a week in intensive care. I mean, I had the same room. I had the same nurses. The way they looked at me, I mean, they just looked at me with this, like, my God, I was like 35 years old and I'm dying from this hideous, hideous disease. I mean, blood's shooting out of me faster than they can pour it in. And every time they fixed me up and sent me on my way, I drank again. I didn't come to AA. I didn't need it. I could do it myself, and that just about killed me. Sometime in there, the last year or so, had a friend. He'd been a friend of my dad's, and he was one of the few people that drank like I did. His name was Marty, and he owned a liquor store. He said he bought it so he'd never run out. And he'd gotten sober. This guy had gone to the penitentiary. He had like 10 DWIs or something. They finally sent him to the penitentiary, and he got sober in the penitentiary. And he came back out. And as I compare in the book, when I read the big book, he's like, he was my Ebby Thatcher, if you will. He was the guy that came all shiny-faced into my life and said, I'm going to AA. I found God. And I just was horrified. Like, oh, no, not you. You were the only one left that drank like I did, you know. Cocktails for breakfast. And well, and every drug I could get my hands on. The ones I ended up on and seeking out were the ones that were booze and a pill or a powder, narcotics, pain medicine, tranquilizers. It's a wonder I didn't die from the mixture of, you know, sleeping pills and vodka. I fell down a lot, I guarantee. But here's this guy, and he's sharing with me about there's a way out. And he said the problem gets removed, because I just keep asking him about, well, what do you do when you want to drink? This just don't drink thing didn't work for me. It's like Nancy Reagan in her big hairdo saying, just say no. I'm like, how? How do you just not drink? I did it for 3 months, and I wanted to die worse. So just not drinking, I mean, I know there is a place for that in AA, but for me, that did not make sense. And he kept telling me the problem would get removed, and I just didn't believe him. So this is sometime in 1990, and in October of 1990, something horrible happened in our family, in my husband's family. It's just the nightmare that every parent has. And we got a phone call in the middle of the night, and Paul's oldest daughter had died suddenly. She had just had a baby less than a week before. She was in the Army. It was Desert Storm time. It had gone from Desert Shield to Desert Storm, and we were all worried about her going over to Saudi Arabia. That's what the family was talking about, Paula going to Saudi Arabia. And we didn't have to worry about that. She had an aneurysm in her heart, and she just dropped dead. Young, seemingly healthy, mother of three. And I remember my husband coming back in the bedroom and just destroyed. He was just destroyed. And I remember thinking, how am I going to drink enough for this one? By this time, I was drinking in bathrooms and closets and trying to smuggle it, you know, in my purse. And I'd be standing in line at the break time at 6 o'clock in the morning with people and they're getting their coffee and donuts, and I'm ordering vodka from behind the counter. And shame and humiliation never kept me sober either. I just did it. It's like, how am I going to drink? I was not able to be there for him. I mean, I was horribly ashamed about this for years and regretful. I mean, I was drunk during that entire time. Found a way. I was drunk at the funeral. I remember drinking vodka in the bathroom of the funeral home, putting it in the trash can and covering it up with paper towels, just like a daily deal. Popping a peppermint and nobody will know. And I'm staggering around this funeral. And it was a bitter cold October. It was October 5th she died. And I mean, the Army people came up, and his family is a huge family. And I just stayed drunk. And God Almighty, selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of my problem. Drinking was a horrible symptom. I managed to stay drunk, and my husband spoke to me about this, and we'd have fights. By this time, we were having fights. Not very often, because I made him real sorry if he ever brought it up. I would make him really regret the fact that he would bring it up. And I used to scream at him, why don't you go to Al-Anon? I'd heard that word, Al-Anon. And he started saying, I am. And I thank God here tonight that he said, I am, because I believe it was his going to Al-Anon that eventually allowed me to hit my bottom and get sober. And one night we'd had a fight, and I said, all right, I'll go to an AA meeting. And I called the answering service, and they sent a really nice woman over to pick me up. It was just real unfortunate. I was so drunk I couldn't walk. But she took me anyway. And I know a lot of people that won't take a drunk to an AA meeting. And I remember, that doesn't make sense to me. Don't take a drunk to an AA meeting. I'm really glad that they took me. I staggered in this meeting, and I remember, you know, the one eye closed, and I'm looking around the sea of chairs, and something happened. I don't know what it was, if I was just drunk enough, lost my balance, tripped, whatever. But I fell face first. I got tangled up in a chair, and I fell face first down the middle of this AA room. And I remember laying there. My arms did not break my fall at all. It's the face first. And I'm laying there thinking, damn. You know, now I've done it. I've blown it here, of all places. I won't be able to even come back here to these people. And what happened then was remarkable to me, because I guess it could have gone either way. And there's some friends later that told me about this, their perspective of it. But what happened was some of the people picked me up, and I was crying and pitiful and snot and just awful. And they set me on one of the couches, and they told me to be quiet, and I wasn't. I was mouthy and windy and just on and pitiful. And they just loved me, and I'm so grateful for that. Had they done something else, I don't know. I mean, at the point I got to, I was willing no matter what, but I don't know. And I went home that night, took three of them to carry me out. And this old wino named Gene Shaw, he died a few years ago, told me later, said, "Debbie, you're the drunkest human being I'd ever seen." And I remember thinking, "You're a wino. How can you say that? That's awful." And they got me home, and interestingly enough, right next door to us was a couple married who were both in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't know that. I'd smuggle my bottles out early in the morning and put them in their trash, because that was always a problem with what to do with the bottles. And the wife, her name was Donna, gave my husband an Al-Anon book, and that's how he started going. But I guess somebody called my friend Marty, and he called me the next morning and said, "What are we going to do?" And I'm pitiful, crying again. It's like, "You don't understand. I fell down. I'm humiliated. I can't ever go back." And I went back. But what I ended up doing that night when I came in was I staggered into the bathroom and fell in the bathtub and pulled the shower curtain down and bumped my head and couldn't get out, crying, pitiful. And my husband, you know, this is like 2 weeks after his daughter died. And he's watching me slosh around and die a moment at a time, a drink at a time. He pulled me up out of the bathtub and he said, "Debbie, I love you. I'll always love you, but I cannot watch you die. I just buried my daughter and I can't do this. And if you'll do something, you know, if you don't do something, I have to go. If you do something about your drinking, I'll stick around. But if not, I have to leave, and it's not because I don't love you." And I heard that. And whether I went to the little treatment center that my mom had been calling around, people had been networking, "What do we do about Debbie?" You know, that was always, "What do we do about Debbie?" And a little treatment center in Herman, Missouri, said they'd take me. And the next morning, there were some phone calls made. The next morning, they came and picked me up. And that next morning, I had my last drink. And that was October 19th of 1990. And I remember that last drink. That's the day I celebrate. I don't celebrate my first day of sobriety. I don't remember it. I was, you know, people were following me around in this hospital, taking my blood pressure and scanning my liver. And because, I mean, I was about ready to blow again. I was purple, bald, bleeding, and looked like I was 8 months pregnant again. And I was just, you know, one more time of that. Most people don't survive one esophageal varices, let alone three. Interesting, my ex-husband, who I tried to get a hold of, has had a couple of those too and is still around. And that's just not very normal. But I mean, I just believe there was stuff I needed to do. My husband ended up getting me that last drink. I told him, the hospital had said, "Don't stop drinking tonight." I'm like, "Okay, not a problem." I told him that, and he said, "I don't believe you." I said, "Call him." He did, and they said, "No, if she stops, she'll go in the DTs." I mean, that's happened to me before. I've seen the purple crawly things shaking, sweating. I knew what was coming, and it was real early that morning of the 19th, and he went to the liquor store. Liquor store didn't open till later, but he knew the manager. He was a friend. And I think about how embarrassed my husband must have been. And he told him what his problem was. He said, "I need a bottle of vodka, and I need it now." And the guy said, "Put it in a paper sack and come back later when I can ring it up." And that half pint of vodka was my last drink. People used to say, Debbie, you want a glass? And I, it comes in one. Why would I want a glass, you know? So I chatted to, the people came from Herman, the little treatment center, and they were nuts down there. I mean, I'm serious. And they came and I chatted to them all the way down there. And I don't remember a lot about that first couple of weeks. It took them over 7 days to detox me. And they weren't real sure about me as far as if I was going to make it. My liver was producing ammonia, and that's not good. And I mean, I was a mess. And a week or so, I don't know the day, but a week or so that I was there, I woke up one morning, and Herman is a great wine-drinking city, and there was a winery right out on my window, and I remember thinking, I always wanted to go there. Never made it. Now I'm in a hospital right across the street from it, detoxing. But this one morning, I woke up real early, and the sun was coming up, and there's mountains, not quite like these mountains here, but there's mountains down there, and it was October in Herman, and it was sunrise, and it was incredibly beautiful. And I was looking out the window, and I was shaking still, and I was sweating, and I couldn't sleep. I was up early, and I looked out that window, and the sun was coming up over this mountain, and it just split like a prism, like a diamond. And it fell on the gold, red, and yellow leaves covering this mountainside, and I just was struck by the moment, and a moment happened for me, and it is a moment that changed my life, much like the first time I drank. It was a spiritual experience, but it was a real one. It wasn't a smoke and mirrors. What happened was, I think I came face to face with the truth about me. And it was nobody's fault anymore. I didn't blame anybody else for where I was. It wasn't because I didn't have one more break or just a few bad breaks, or I could have or I would have. I mean, I saw the truth of my life, and it was over. And it was right. I was in a corner, and I couldn't get out by myself. And I surrendered at that moment. I dropped to my knees, and it's not something that I'd ever really done before. I dropped to my knees and it's been assumed a lot of times that I surrendered to a wonderful conception of a loving God. And what I surrendered to was the hideous hopelessness of my alcoholism. And when I did that, God showed up. And I had an experience that is described in the book. Bill describes his experience. It's similar. Something washed through me, and it was warm, and it was from the inside out. It wasn't from the outside. I mean, all my life I'd been looking outside, and it was something happened inside of me and opened up and came out and washed around me and warmed me. And a voice, I heard a voice, and it wasn't my voice, said, "It's going to be okay." And that was not ever what it was going to be for me. It was always going to get worse. And from that moment on, I mean, I was crying, I was sobbing. I knew something had happened to me when I stood up. The desire to drink alcohol was gone. And if this thing, this power could do that, then I want more, is what I thought. And I believe it was the power of a loving God. And I'd finally been humbled enough by the truth that I tapped into it. And it washed me. And I've been different ever since. And I stood up from that, and I remember my husband called, and I tried to explain it to him, and I was crying, and all the people at the treatment center were trying to figure out what the hell had gone on, and I couldn't tell them. I didn't really know, but I knew it was a power. And I call it God. It's simple. It's short. It's not allied with any sect, denomination, or political organization at all. It's just my concept, and it works. And I walked away from that experience knowing that it loved me. It cared for me. And that's never changed. I became willing to go to AA. I mean, they were making us go at this treatment center, loading us up in the nut bus and taking us to different places and going to the meetings and And, you know, I became willing, but I didn't like it. I think it, oftentimes it's like, you have to like it to do it. It's like, nah. You know, acceptance is not approval. That's what my first sponsor told me over and over and over. It's like, it has nothing to do with whether I agree with it or not. I just went. And I prayed every day after that experience on my knees. I mean, why wouldn't I? I drank vodka just about or something every day after that first experience with alcohol. I mean, the first time I drank enough, I fell off a cliff, for heaven's sake. I fell off a cliff at the Missouri River Bluffs. That didn't stop me. I did it every day I could after that. This experience left me changed and different, and the desire to drink was gone. It's like, I'm doing this every day, and I have. For over 12 years, every day, at least twice a day. And I came home, it was around Thanksgiving, and I was willing to go to, I never went to 90 meetings in 90 days. I have never told anybody they had to. My experience was I made a commitment to 4 AA meetings a week, and I went to them. I didn't know if they were good meetings. Who knew? They were kind of close to my house. That's why I went to them. And one of them was a women's group. And I didn't know how to be friendly with women very well, and I learned a lot by going to that group. It was my home group for 6 years. And I learned about service and a lot of things there. But that first year, I'm going to 4 meetings a week, and I'm starting to meet people. And I mean, I'm showing up, and I'm just like, God, I mean, I thought I was going to erupt into flame sitting in the chairs of the meeting. I was still so self-centered. You know, it took the bottle away, it took the alcohol away, and all that stuff I described before I ever drank about being frightened and self-centered and guilty and ashamed and self-conscious. I mean, that was all still there. They took the alcohol away, and there it was, even fuller and bigger. Like, now what do I do? And I just kept showing up at meetings, and I just, God, if somebody looked like they were going to talk to me, I'd just go the other way, and I'd go late and leave early, but I'd go, and I was praying, and I read this book. I read this book from cover to cover, and there was words I had to look up. I had this big dictionary. I mean, resentment, that was never used in my home growing up. You have a resentment against your mother. No, you want to kill somebody. That's how we talked about it, and I mean, it was just written in words I didn't know. I'm looking up words, and I read that book. And somebody told me, you'll find your story in there, Debbie. And I kept reading, and I kept reading. And the last story, it was called, I don't know what it is in the new one now, it was called To Handle Sobriety. And I thought, that was my problem, always. How do I handle life without an anesthetic? Without something to change my consciousness. And in this story, this man had several esophageal ruptures, and it's like, that was my story. And slowly, I became more comfortable in these AA meetings. But I didn't like them, and I didn't agree with it, and I didn't understand it, but I did it anyway. And things began to change. And things were changing in our home, you know. I was going to 4 meetings a week and starting to go to Dairy Queen afterwards for ice cream and talking this new language, AA lingo. And my husband was going to that Al-Anon meeting, that one that he'd been going to. And I think he got a little resentful of the fact that I was gone all the time. I mean, at least when I was drinking, he knew where I was. I was either in the emergency room or passed out on the floor or on the couch. I mean, he could always pretty much know where I was. He didn't have any idea now. And things were weird. I mean, I was beginning to wake up. And I remember it was tense and uncomfortable. And we had conversations. And there were some things that we had been doing. I mean, we'd been having sex as a form of communication for years. And, you know, I started wanting to talk. He's like, talk? Talk about what? And, I mean, it was an interesting first year or so. And I just kept going. And at the end of that first year, some folks that we became acquainted with formed a club, an Al-Anon club. And I remember going down there, and they needed some construction work, painting and walls built, and I kind of volunteered my husband because that's what he does. And I remember being worried about, oh, I wonder if my new AA friends will like him. And I thought, Debbie, you were the asshole, not him. And we became involved in the formation of this club. And gosh, we'd get down there and clean it all up and make the coffee, and people would come in, and everybody was smoking back then, and we'd stay till 2 o'clock in the morning and mop the floors and clean the tables and get all the ashtrays. I mean, we really were involved in that and took pride in that and wanted it to go, and it's still going. About the end of the first year, I made the mistake of saying, we'd been down to Lake of the Ozarks, and there was a Sunday morning 10 a.m. spirituality meeting, and it was wonderful. It was open, and I remember saying, we need one of those here in Columbia. And this guy said, okay, why don't you start one? I said, oh, no, not me. I don't know how to do that. I've never done anything like that before. And I learned how to do that. I showed up every Sunday morning at 10 o'clock with a topic. God, I think I led that meeting for 2 years. People must have just hated me. Oh, no, not her again. I mean, I'm crying through my entire first 2 years of sobriety. And just talking about God and the experience I had had and the solution. That was on every sponsee's inventory, fifth step I ever heard, resentment. If I hear the solution one more time, I'm going to kill her. And I began to grow. I began to sponsor. I took those steps. I finally got a sponsor. I wasn't really too willing about that, but I finally stopped. I wanted to stop feeling guilty about how I felt when the meeting was on sponsorship. Motives are not important in AA, I don't think, for why we do what we do. I wanted to stop feeling guilty every time sponsorship came up. And so I got a sponsor. And I took those steps. And I took, 1, 2, and 3, basically, in the hospital. But I realized more about the bondage of self was my problem, and that I could be relieved at least of the bondage. If not, I don't think I've been totally relieved of self at all. But the desire to drink was lifted, and a few other things. One thing was removed that, as long as I stay grateful, I think it will stay removed, and that is self-pity. I have not felt self-pity since I got sober, because I've had a grateful day. I don't care if the world has come to an end, and it has almost a few times, I have been able to remain grateful a day at a time for something. And I did an imperfect four-step. I started writing. I was more frightened not to do the steps than to do them. I hear people talk an awful lot, I'm so scared to do them. Well, I was more scared not to. And I just moved forward, and I didn't feel all that better after I did my fifth step. As a matter of fact, I came home, and there was a note on my door. It said my husband was at the emergency room. It's like, well, this sucks. And what had happened, interestingly enough, is that he needed to do a fifth step. He had gone, I think the term is hysterical blindness. He had gone blind, just standing at the sink that day. And he managed to get next door. We had a doctor living next door, and took him to the hospital, and some people talked to him, and finally his sight came back, and they said, has there been anything big going on in your life in the last year or so? And his oldest daughter had died. And, my husband has his own story, but, he didn't deal with stuff very well either. God, he married me. Look at his decisions back then. He didn't know. And they said, well, Mr. Neal, I think you need to find either a priest or a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And that's what he did, and he hasn't gone blind since. So I didn't feel real good after my fourth and fifth step. There wasn't any bright lights or anything like that. My comfort came in knowing that I'd done what I was told to do and what was suggested to do. I never did that. I got expelled from high school, and I worked hard for that. You know, they told me, my dad would say, all I want you to do, Debbie, is graduate from high school. Well, the one thing I made sure I didn't do was graduate from high school. I had done something that was suggested. And I saw I did see, and more so as I've been sober, but I saw the cycles in my life. It wasn't 50 different horrible victim relationships I'd had. It was one over and over and over. Just different names, just different forms. I saw where selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seeking affected my life and everything. I saw that as the root of my problem. And look for self is my mantra. And anytime I'm disturbed, there's some form of self. If nothing else, I'm self-reliant. I am running the show. And I got to see that in later fifth steps. Six and seven, I became willing. I mean, I don't know. I remember sitting in my backyard, I was laying out in the sun one summer day, and I was reading the 12 and 12 and 6 and 7, and something clicked with me, and I was reading it out loud. The air conditioner was going really loud so that the neighbors wouldn't hear anything I was saying, and I just became willing to have God remove my defects of character. And I made a list of people I had harmed. I sponsor a lot of women, and they say, I don't know who that was. I don't believe that. I think every one of us knows that list real well. We try to make it go away for a long time, but I search. I know. I did. I knew. And step nine, I mean, I'd had miracles happen in my sobriety. I'd been changing. I'd been growing. But man, oh man. When I started doing that ninth step, the world opened up, and my reliance and relationship and understanding of this power that was guiding me grew. I mean, undeniable, like that was a God thing. I kept saying that all the time. All this stuff would happen. And just a couple that just made such a huge difference in my life. One was an old boyfriend, and every time, you know, we had our song. Everybody has a song. And whenever that song would come on, I changed the radio station. I didn't want to hear it. It reminded me of him. I hadn't made amends. And when I finally called this guy, I found him. He worked at a charter hospital, and got a hold of him. And he kept saying, Debbie, I'm at work. I really can't. He didn't want anything to do with me. I had burned it to the ground with this guy. And I said, I'm trying to apologize. And there was this silence on the end. It's like, oh, okay. And I told him I was wrong, and I'd been selfish, and I regretted it, and was there anything I could do? And we laughed a little, and you know what? After that, I hear that song, and I am free. I don't have to turn the radio to a different station. It's like, this is about freedom. I lived in such bondage of alcohol and of my head, my memories, my shame, and my regrets. And this program has just freed me. My favorite one was a church I'd made an amend to down the Lake of the Ozarks. I'd moved in with a homeless man that lived down there one time. Believe it or not, you can do that. And he'd showed me how to beg money from a church. And I didn't know anything about churches. They give you money, okay. We went and got some money, and I bought some Mad Dog. Who were we talking about Mad Dog earlier? It's like, God, $5, I bought me some Mad Dog. Cheap and quick, and it came up during prayer and meditation. It came up, I go by this church to go to conferences down at the lake, and I should pay that money back with interest. And we drove by, and nobody was home at this church this one time. I couldn't believe it. Nobody was there. So there was an Al-Anon conference the next month or so, and so we'll catch it that month. And I know why they weren't there that time, because this time we drove up, and I had the money in my hand, and I walked in, and there was all kinds of cars in the parking lot, and I said to this woman that had a bunch of keys, she looked important, said, do you work here? And she said, I'm the minister. I don't know. How do I know? And I said, you guys loaned me some money a long time ago, and I want to pay it back. And she got this big smile on her face, and She said, "What a coincidence." And I said, "Oh, I don't believe in coincidences." She said, "A little later on today, we're going to put one of our parishioners, one of our gals, has finally gotten the courage to leave an abusive relationship that she's been in a long time. We've got a bus ticket for her. She's disabled. And we've got a bus ticket. We've got enough money together to get her ticket to get her to another city. But there's a layover, and we didn't have enough money for her dinner. And now we do." And I just started crying. And she gave me a hug, and I thought, that's why they weren't here last month. You know, if I am to be an open channel, I'm supposed to go where I'm guided. I mean, I think I'm supposed to do one thing, and God's like, "Oh, well, look at this. You think you're doing that? Well, watch this. This is what's really going on." And I mean, every time I've been willing to make that amend, it's just been bigger. I think the channel just opens up more and more. Step 10 has been, for me, trying to live a day at a time. And it means when I make a mess, I clean it up. It doesn't mean if I make a mess. It means when I make a mess, I clean it up. Sooner the better. And my daddy always said, the eraser wears out before the pencil does. And I believe that. I mean, I make a lot of mistakes. But I am willing today to say I was wrong. I don't like him to go on and on. I don't like to feel bad. I'm sober. I'm awake. I'm not under an anesthetic today. And I'm conscious. I remember last year, my husband and I were stripping a floor. That's part of what we do. We strip the wax off this tile floor. And 3 months before that, I'd gotten some of that stripper in my eye, and it cost me a trip to the doctor, the eye doctor, and drops every day, 5 times a day. Jesus, it was a hassle. And I had just gotten my eye cleaned up, and we were on our hands and knees stripping this floor, and he splashed some, and it got up in my eye again, and I just went off. And I just cussed and started carrying on. It's like, "Don't you know," blah, blah, carrying on and being mean and rageful. And he looked at me and he said, "Huh, I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to do that." And I stopped for a minute and I said, "Of course you didn't." What I reacted to was fear. I got scared. I just cleared up from 3 months of putting on, I thought, "Oh, here we go again, self." It was a self-centered fear. And I apologized. It's like, that's the kind of stuff I got to do in step 10 when that stuff comes up, because it does. And step 11 for me has just been this huge, big hoop, this big, all-inclusive. I mean, everything from praying on my knees every day for the last 12 years, twice a day at least, to just little things that remind me. I mean, I have not little games, but just these little things that I do to be reminded. I mean, I try to rely on this loving God the way I relied on a bottle of vodka. I relied on it for everything, good, bad, and everything in the middle. So when anything comes up and I have an opportunity to pray or tap into this source of power, I do it. And there's all kinds of things on the way down here. Whenever we see a red-tailed hawk, I mean, I say it's special to me and my husband. I say a prayer, and we see a lot of them. Whenever certain numbers come up on our digital clock, particularly 1111. That is just a really cool number for me. I don't know why. When I was getting sober, I'd be laying in bed and getting ready to go to sleep, and I'd look at the clock, and I'd be grateful for my sobriety, for my day, and I'd be thanking God, and I'd look, and it'd be 1111. And I'd pray for that minute, however long, until the clock switched to 1112. Our license plate is 1111. It's not 1111 that was already taken. It's ELVN-11. People say, "Elvin the second? What's that?" It's mine. It's our deal. It's not yours. It's okay. And step 11, tradition 11. I mean, I love that. When the clock says 4:49, I mean, I think about acceptance. I mean, just little things that I use to improve my conscious contact with God. There's a million things. Rainbows, prisms. I wear prism earrings when I work, little crystals that shine lights all over when I'm in the sun. It just reminds me of a power greater than myself. I mean, that is the most important thing in my life, my relationship to this power and how I can improve it. When I was in school, they told me, Debbie, you don't know the basics. I mean, I couldn't remember, I couldn't memorize, I didn't know my times tables. I didn't know the basics. And some almost 30 years later, I come to AA and y'all say, Debbie, you don't know the basics. And how to basically get through a day, I didn't know, without reliance on something that was trying to kill me, something that changed me into this hideous perception of it was just an ugly human being. People told me that when I drank, Debbie, when you drink, you're ugly. And they were right. Step 12 is practicing these principles. It's carrying this message, and I remember wondering, what are the principles and what's this message? There's no chapter just that says that. What exactly? There's a little card I just dropped on the floor there. It lists the principles. Honesty, willingness, integrity. God almighty, I didn't have any integrity. You could not rely on what I said to be the truth, or if I said I'd be somewhere, that I'd be there. I mean, I have learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous through service, through having a home group and learning to say yes. I was talking to some friends about that. I learned to say yes and to show up and have a key to that church and to make coffee. And I don't drink coffee, but it doesn't matter. And saying yes to sponsorship and doing that just, I don't know, all over the place. I finally come to where I don't tell anybody what to do. I just tell them what I did. And they do whatever they're going to do anyway. And my job is just to try to love them. I had a gal that was smoking pot, and it got very public in our little AA community, and people were wanting to kick her out and do a lot of things and make her stand down from different services. She hadn't had a drink for 5 years, but she was smoking dope, and they wanted to punish her. And one gal I sponsored was so angry, she called World Service. She reported her to World Services, and they said... They said, instead of being, you know, so angry and judging her, why don't you see what you can do to help her? And I thought, amen, well said. And just recently she's told me, it's been about a little over 2 years, she said, you know, it's not working anymore, and I think I'm ready to put it down. And I thought, good for you. You get to wake up some more now. And that's what I've gotten to do, a spiritual awakening. I was asleep. And I've gotten to wake up, become conscious a little bit more each day to this power that is, I mean, I've just scratched just a little bit of the surface. And God, to be here at this conference with all these years of sobriety, and I mean, there was a meeting Thursday night that just blew my socks off. And a lot of wisdom, a lot of experience, and a lot of strength, and a lot of hope. And if I have anything to share, it's that there's hope. If you have one breath left in you, there's hope. Because there is no way at all to get from where I was to where I am today without the power of a loving God. And I see it and I feel it more and more each day, and I really have felt it here so far this weekend. Thank you so much for having me. God bless you. Oh my God.